podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Anfield Index Under Pressure podcast. I'm not Gags Tandon, I'm Dan Kennett. Gags is being a victim of the hectic winter schedule, having collecting so many pressing stats in such a short spaces of time over the Christmas period did for him as well. But with me to go through, this could be the longest or busiest pod in history, the match of the season and one of the biggest talking points of the season. I've got our resident sports scientist, Simon Brundish. Evening, Si.
Evening, Darth.
and editor of AnfieldIndex.com, Dan Rhodes. Rhodesy, good evening.
Evening, Dan. Good to see we've rotated Gags, rested him. We're not risking him too much, have we? It's been well too hard.
He's definitely didn't want to risk burnout. Yeah.
well in that red zone.
We couldn't even put him on the bench. We couldn't even bring him on. Later on.
That kind of shape. He needs to get some o'clock training.
Right, enough with this frivolity. We've got far, far, far too much to go. I mean, judging by how long it took me to draw up the agenda for today's show, I don't know. I'm going to try and keep it to 75 minutes, but we shall see. So,
not a chance.
Manchester.
Take that long to read through it, again, yeah, Dan.
Right. Point one, right. Where else are we going to start but Manchester City? I was lucky enough to be there on New Year's Eve. It was an absolutely fantastic game, absolutely unbelievable game. Considering how little football that was played, it was a fantastic game. But we're going to start with the usual on-ball stuff, right? So, Rhodesy, we are going to deviate a lot from the normal pattern of the show, by the way, tonight, but do you want us to start off with the normal kind of summary you give for the on-ball?
Well, yeah. There's not much of a summary to give because it's pretty much the lowest in every much in each of the counts that I usually cover. Shots on goal, 5. We'll come back to how few that is in context. We only conceded 9. 2 shots in the box City managed to have. One of them went out for a throw-in. The other one came off Sterling's shin. No big chances for anybody. 11 chances created in total in the match. 5 from Liverpool, 6 from City. It was 15 penalty box touches to 13 for Liverpool. So in terms of the stats that we usually cover, massively down on all of them. It wasn't a game of end-to-end chances, was it, Dan? Not even in the slightest.
Well, it certainly wasn't a game of chances. So it's just like I think what we've got to tell you is when there's two top teams like Liverpool and City going at it and so few chances being created. Well, I think the first things we need to do is look at. Well, it's not normal for this to happen to either of these teams. So let's start off with looking at how much City managed to restrict us to by our normal standards. Now, there's two things here. One is the other thing is that we scored an early goal, didn't we? Fantastic. We'll come to that in a minute. But so that might have limited ourselves, but I think mostly it was City. So how often, Rhodesy, do we have that level of shots and expected goals?
Well, in terms of expected goals, there's only been 10 games in the past 5 seasons, and that's Steamax expected goals models, where we've had fewer than 0.5 expected goals in a game. That's what we had against City. They had 0.6. So just 10
10 times in 5 years.
10 times in 5 years. So fewer than 5% of the games we have that little amount of volume of expected goals. It's even worse for shots. In terms of shots, the only time where we've had fewer than 6, so we had 5, it was the Aston Villa away. Remember that in 13-14 season?
Sturridge scored a great goal.
Yeah, Sturridge scored. I couldn't believe it. I had to check the data again. So them were the only 2 games in the past 5 seasons where we've only had 5 shots. And it's not happened at Anfield in the day that we've got. So, you know, 99.48% of matches, we have more shots than that. So it wasn't... I think the early goal obviously affects it. It certainly seemed to, I thought, affect our tactics. That's depending on whether that was Man City imposing themselves or us consciously deciding to do that. But, yeah, it was The cliche stands. It was a game of very few chances. Don't you? Nothing was created.
Okay, so just before I bring Cyan, because I know he'd be chomping at the bit here. So let's just talk about how much we restricted City, because we did an unbelievable job. I thought on you know, for such a talented team and Guardiola team. So you know, was it unprecedented what we did to them?
A huge outlier this season for Guardiola City side. And I'm only looking at the games against the other top six sides, because City have had some huge figures against some of the other sides. Bournemouth, I think they had 3.7 or something.
This is all expected goals now.
Against Man United, they had 1.9. This is creation. Spurs was the only other one on a similar level, but they did create 1.1 expected goals. Chelsea was one of City's biggest of the season, 2.6. And Arsenal, it was 1.7. So the 0.6 that they've created is by far the lowest all season. It's the only other time they've gone under one expected goals was against Burnley 2 days later when they had a player sent off after about half an hour. So City always create at least one.
Yeah. And so when they played Chelsea, 2.6 expected goals. I mean, the Kevin De Bruyne miss, which is probably the turning point of the whole Premier League season. Really, that was probably about 0.9.
Yeah, it's as close to one expected goal as you're going to get.
Yeah, yeah, wow. So the only team that's come close to us is Spurs this season, restricting what we did, and we were 40% better than Spurs as well. So that's some going. Brundish, bringing you in. Right, I know you've got some thoughts on this. So let's just give us your on ball highlights before we do some deeper dives.
I'm looking else at other stuff during this current. The biggest on ball fact was how little we actually had the ball in the game. It's staggering. The huge drop off. So 600 touches pretty much, and we had 905, I think, against Sunderland, which is much more normal for us, high 800. Yeah, what can you say? We didn't really do anything with the ball. It was the narratives of how brilliant we were come about with how we controlled and contained City without the ball. Us on the ball, the highlights were all fairly detrimental from our season averages of possession. Passing percentage was really, really down. The number of misplaced passes were up. There was one standout might be it was Mignolet's. It was our goalie's highest number of long passes made this season with 23. We currently average 15, I think, per game attempts at long passes, and it was 23. So that's significant. Maybe that leads into something tactical. We've discussed this before, Dan. But, while we're at it, can we just say what a phenomenal goal it was?
Yeah, I mean, it was an absolute scandal that wasn't in the goal of the month for December on Match of the Day. That was how were there eight better goals than that in December alone? It was amazing.
There was possibly one.
I think Paul Tompkins put it best on his post match when he said that it was in HD slow mo. You could see the beads of sweat coming off Wanner Aldum's forehead when he I don't know. He had so much to do, didn't he? Though when the ball came in and it was a wrong foot cross from Lallana as well, wasn't it? So it was just an unbelievable goal.
Pretty sure Lallana's left footed, you know. But yeah, it was. I don't know if it was a great cross. It was a cross, and it was a great header. Brilliant run, because he was a big part in the build up in the first place, getting the ball back in right on the edge of our box, wasn't it? And then sprinted the whole length of the pitch pretty much.
And the leap as well.
The leap.
The neck muscles, that deflection.
It felt like slow motion watching it in real time.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's definitely a trampoline near the penalty spot, isn't there, somewhere in the road end, secret trampoline.
Do you know what? One thing leading to the one of those the nice little stats I would like to look into is
put
it up on the sheet. Yeah, bringing trampolines on the pitch or crossing percentage. Lallana's 38% this season.
Yeah,
let him have some more crosses.
There was a beauty for Emre Chaning's Watford, wasn't there?
Yeah, absolute beauty. And that I think the one For Emre Can was a brilliant cross. I think that one was just a cross.
It was, there's a couple of low ones as well, wasn't there? I think I can seem to, a couple of low for goals for Firmino, I think, seem to recall as well.
Yeah.
What we're saying, a club fine for Milner if he attempts a cross with his left foot, if Lallana's, if Lallana's near him.
There you go. Milner's currently 14%. Lallana's 38%. Just let him cross.
Pass your 14% to his.
Yeah, exactly. It was nice. He was actually one interesting thing was how much he was on the left compared to him. He's been on the right with Wijnaldum on the left, doesn't he, of the three? And there was definitely something tactical that put him over that side.
Well, we brought Emre back in for this game, and you know, so Firmino went back to centre forward, didn't he? And you know, I thought Lallana was nominally going to be left of the three with Mane on the right.
I suppose. Yeah, you're right. It feels like
like a year ago for that, so that game, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Because we're not as excited as we were then.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about on ball is, and this is kind of, we touched on this after the Everton game. Now, because the Everton game was a bit of a fight. Now, the City game wasn't a fight. It was, I don't know what it was. It was really hard. It was like a permanent 90-minute contest. It wasn't a fight. It wasn't aggressive, you know, really thud and blunder challenges or anything like that. It was almost like a fitness race. We'll come onto that in the off ball section. But opt to do stuff off the ball. Also, they recall on ball events for defensive actions, so tackles, interceptions, recoveries, blocks, clearances, and that such like. Now, Rhodesy, I did task you with trying to. Can we look at the Opta defensive events and just to see in that City game what they were like compared to our season average? Well, so did you manage to find anything?
Yeah, in terms of, so I'll go through all of them. There was an increase in every single one: aerial duels, tackles, interceptions, clearances, and blocks. The only one where there was a slight reduction was in recoveries. We usually have around 64; we had 59. But yeah, aerial duels up 20%, interceptions up 20%. Clearances up 20%, blocks up 20%. If you look at the amount of tackles, some of the individuals, Lallana 7-4 in terms of tackles. So he had 7 in this game, nearly twice as many tackles. Mane, 5 tackles, usually has 1.8. So, you know, more than twice as many tackles as he's usually trying. Firmino as well with 5. Aerial duels as well. I know there weren't any creation going on, but some of the defensive on-ball numbers and the off-ball numbers are unbelievable. Firmino, 12 aerial duels. What's
the thing is, are they
12?
But you know, that was insane. But are they a function of the tactics? Are they a function of City dominating us? Because if this was the other way around, they had 50% more passing, more touches than we did. 50% more passes than we did. No wonder our stats are, our defensive stats are up. They had to be.
Exactly.
So we had more opportunity. So is this?
No, I'm just saying this is complete switcheroo for us. What we've been used to.
Yeah, 100%. So, but that the conversation is this tactical or is this a function of them being better than us?
I think it would be. But I'd like to see that game again without the early goal. You know, I think that did have something to do with it. You know, because you know, do you think that's do you buy that side?
Yeah, goals make a huge difference, but then. We've scored. How many times have we taken a goal early, fairly early goal this season, or been ahead and been shocking afterwards and let them back in? So I think this is a completely different mindset. I think we were focused in a different way. You know what? This conversation completely leads into the other stats that are on the sheet about how many times how good we are against big teams. It almost feels like, despite us being really good this season, it almost feels like typical Liverpool in. How rubbish we are against the rubbish teams.
Yeah.
And how we pick our game up. We're like one of the middle ranking teams that pick your game. You know, we hear all the time, it's so hard for Liverpool to play against these poor teams because this is their cup final, so they get up for it. We do that. We really do it against the other 5 teams in the top 6, or the other 6 teams because it's Everton. So we really pick our game up. We're phenomenal against these big teams.
Yeah.
It's just that, we just seem to miss something against everybody else.
So, you know, your question was, do you think it was a product of City being good or a tactical decision? Well, I think there's two things. One, I think the decision to start Emre in this game, I think that tells me a lot about what the game plan was. The other thing was, I think that Klopp and Guardiola bring in a lot of history from the Bundesliga. I think they played each other 6 times. And I think they've got two wins each, I think.
Yeah, big ones as well.
Yeah, so they know each other quite well, and I think they basically thought, well, they're both going to be doing exactly the same things with their new teams, and so it was almost like, well, they've played that game before, and I wonder if we'd watched Bayern against Dortmund again now, we might see Dortmund doing a similar thing to what we did against City.
Could well be. I did wonder if we were going to go change the formation a little bit, but we did go 4-2-3-1, but we really didn't.
It was definitely 4-3-3, wasn't it? Just with Emre ahead of Henderson with Wijnaldum, wasn't it?
Yeah. So maybe we just went man for man because they have the other inverted triangle, don't they?
Yeah, I quite liked the matchup before kickoff with Fernandinho and Yaya against Emre and Wijnaldum. I quite like that in our favour, you know. Plus, we had Henderson as well. So, and obviously, their three behind the striker were nominally fantastic, you know. So, but but I quite like the midfield matchup anyway for us.
In off ball terms, Fernandinho and De Bruyne, they're beasts. They do a hell of a lot, a big shift. Not quite Lallana, but they're more than capable of doing a big shift. That we're perfectly aware how poor Yaya is. He's not as poor as he has been, but still, you're going to back our three boys against them in midfield, aren't you?
Yeah. Yes. Okay. I thought
the adding on to what you did, the output of Aguero, De Bruyne, Sterling, and Silva is the credit goes to the midfield rather than the defence. I thought they stopped and get into the defence. The defence did a lot of work. But it was more clearance work, aerial work, whereas I thought those three just broke the passing lines. They did.
Yeah.
It didn't have any touches in the box. No. Sergio Aguero usually has six shots or five shots a game across his history in the league. I know he's just back from a...
I've got Aguero stats, by the way, for the game. Zero shots in the box, zero chances created, 2 out of 4 take-ons. And do you want to guess how many passes he completed in the final third?
10.
2. That's Sergio Aguero, probably the best player in the Premier League.
I've just loved watching De Bruyne for the past.
Are you sure it's not Sterling? I'm pretty sure it's Raheem Sterling.
What's that?
Oh. The best player. Their best player is without doubt Raheem Sterling. I've heard it many times.
I like the front four, but if I was going to pick out any of them, I'd pick De Bruyne.
So Sterling's on the agenda. So let's do him quickly now, Si.
Just to interject one other set of stats really that demonstrates how ineffective they were against our midfield. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 players had more passes than any of our players, right? But in the top 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 attacking third passes, we have 3. We had better quality in the final third than they did. Because we were just clogging up the passing lanes in midfield. They just couldn't get through us through the phenomenal workload of our really 6. Because that's basically what they did. If you look at the average position of Firmino, Lallana, Wijnaldum, Mane, they're basically in a line of 4. We didn't play with a striker. That's kind of probably why we didn't really create anything. But we just clogged up their midfield. They couldn't get out. We allowed what's he called? Bravo. Where they bought him to be a sweeper, didn't we? Didn't they? And I think he had 18 passes less than would be expected of him typically. And so we didn't allow him to get the ball in the first place. So we basically let their centre backs play it into the midfield, and then that was it. Won it back again.
Just to try and summarise what you were saying, though, in a quite nice, succinct one, I really like the territory stat you can get on Prozone. Sorry, Prozone. I wish we had Prozone. on StatZone. And so City had 57% possession, but only 46% territory. So that shows you how deep the possession was. They were recycling in their own half, their own defensive third, and just between the defensive third and the halfway line on their side. So I think that tells you a lot about the nature of the game and what, like you said, the what we did with our defensive shape. I thought it was superb. You could see I was high up in the main stand.
The shape
was as clear as a bell. What we were, you know, it was almost like a big semicircle around the two centre halves.
We almost turned them into the bad version of us. when we're not doing well, I think we're very similar to City. I think we play a very similar way. City gets slaughtered because it's Pep and we pick on him for some insane reason. But I think we have very, very similar profiles. Absolutely. Throughout the team, attacking and defending the way we do it. They're better at dribbling than us. We have slightly more errors than defensively than they do, and we pass around the box slightly more than they do. But it's very similar apart from that. And when we get bad, we get people that they kind of press just in front of. They allow our centre backs the ball and then press that pass out and stop Henderson doing anything with the ball, don't we? And I didn't think it's not the low block that's caused us a problem this season. It's the mid block right on the halfway line stopped us getting out that. And I think that's exactly what we did to them. We didn't sit on the edge of our box. We literally sat in a bank at the halfway line and went, go on then.
Yeah. What's so extraordinary about it is if you do the team styles before the game, you'd say these are the two best attacking sides in the league. And out of the top six, possibly the two worst defensive sides in the league, two worst defensive sides out of the top six. So you'd think it's going to be open, loads of chances. that's the way the profile will go. You wouldn't expect either of these two sides to be able to defend so well. And
it was like Chelsea against Man United 10 years ago. We just cancelled each other out and then we robbed them with a brilliant goal.
Yeah.
Great. I'm more than happy it went our way.
So, to finish off on the on-ball, I have got Raheem Sterling on the agenda. Raheem Sterling versus Milner. As I said, I was in the main stand, and obviously that was in the first half, was right in front of us. And I thought it was a pretty intriguing duel. Either of you want to come in on Sterling? Have we got anything on Sterling for this match?
Sorry, I didn't even... You make such a bad agenda, Dan.
I haven't got anything stats-wise. I would say I'm sure I've seen it was 50%. Is dribbling success, but
yeah, you got 6 out of 14. Six out of 14 dribbles, so 14 attempted is a fucking a lot.
yeah, it was a target. Yeah, if you look at their possession distribution, it was all towards the right hand side. Sterling targeting our left hand side again.
But the interesting thing I thought is they did get in twice. Just the cross across the box didn't go to the right person, and ours did.
Yeah,
same with the Firmino chance, wasn't it, that he didn't control. There were a couple of occasions where either of them could have got in.
It's true.
But I thought Milner made two or three really good tackles, and two or three times he was absolutely pleased.
Yeah. I thought he played quite well, in fairness.
I thought he stuck at it really well, considering...
I thought he had a lot of help. He had a lot of help. And I think City didn't help themselves by loading that side, which enabled us to put three players there. If they'd have actually stuck any player out on their left wing, it would have stretched us hugely, and it would have given Sterling such a much greater opportunity. But they didn't. Yeah. They allowed us just to you know, double bank all the time and then triple at some points.
Yeah, well, Emre was helping out Milner most of the time, and a couple of times he really did beat Sterling as well. And there was a couple of ding-dongs between Firmino and Sterling as well at a couple of times, which was quite amusing. But yeah, Sterling...
Some recoveries again, didn't he, Emre?
Yeah. Sterling's match summary from I put out on the account was 9 out of 14 passes in the final third, one chance created, 6 out of 14 take-ons, and 0 of 5 crosses. So, I mean, he tried a lot, but it was just ineffective, just like all of City. Yes, and City's...
It's true, but then if you look at it, I'm not playing devil's advocate, I just think it was a much more even game. If you look at the player influence, Sterling is at least as big as any of our players in midfield.
Yeah. I think
they didn't score, we did.
Yeah,
let's have that kind of defensive performance. Why, I don't understand, if we can do that against the best attacking team in the league, why we can't hold a 2-goal lead or at least a 1-goal lead for the last 10 minutes of the game. I don't understand. Where's the focus go?
So difficult to explain, isn't it? I just wanted to finish off with one stat from a friend of the show, Andrew Beasley. Man City average 40 penalty box touches per match. The lowest they've had this season was 25, and then they had 13 at Anfield. So I think that's testament to how well we contained Guardiola's City.
And that containing required a lot of off-ball work.
Nice segue, Mr. Rhodes. So, total distance summary. Let's start off with what were the headline stats for the teams and the players say?
So they beat us in distance just a little bit, but we're just under 119. They're just over 119, both insane numbers, but there seem to be some insane numbers knocking around this month. Lots of them at a time of year when you wouldn't expect it. So maybe we've got all new training methods and recovery protocols in place. I'm not entirely sure. Gags is a funny fucker. But the headline is the cyborg we have in midfield with magnificent hair and tram lines.
Mr. Nivea David Platt.
Mr. Nivea. Jesus.
The Nivea cyborg. Yep,
David Platt with a left foot. 12.8 kilometres. Yeah, that's phenomenal. Over the Christmas period, I think over the last five games, he has had three of the top six performances in the league this season in distance per game. He got crushed last night for the first time, so, you know, fans everywhere will be crying in their tea that Dan Gosling beat him and broke the 14K mark, which is just insane.
That Dan Gosling used to play for Everton, who scored that goal.
Gosling and Sermon, they are both in, they're just beasts.
Yeah.
The other thing, as well as the phenomenal cyborg, is the German cyborg we have in there. You can be the Terminator, can't you? That's that kind of stereotype, if that's not too racist. 12.5K again.
Xenophobic.
Xenophobic, maybe, yeah. But this is no prejudice. He's just awesome. He does have nice. Do you know what? Maybe it's got something to do with it. It's just the quality of hair relates to, say, that Dan Gosling. He looks like a mucker. He doesn't have the good hair. I'm a man that cares about hair, let me tell you. 12.5K, and it's getting up there with his average this season now. He's a machine and doesn't stop going.
Yeah, 12.5K for him. Yeah, and 12.8 for Lallana, 12.5 for Emre, and then the stack of players over 11 as well.
Yeah. And to bear in mind, without being specific here, there are always comparisons with the German model and the German league, and we had six players against City run for do more stats than any German player, not any player in the German league this season.
Wow,
that's mad. Yeah.
We have more in the league anyway. We have more sprints. But that's phenomenal.
I have a question for you, Si. Was the Man City Liverpool game the highest match aggregate for total distance this season in the Premier League?
As far as I can see, it was. There is the huge outlier in the stuff.
137K.
With Borough and Hull. If that's true,
the one we mentioned last show.
Yeah. Exactly, that could be. But saying that after last night and Arsenal's 100-minute game, that's even just adding 5 minutes on makes a whole lot of difference. But a 100-minute game Arsenal played last night against Bournemouth, I think I haven't seen Arsenal's, but I've seen Bournemouth's, and that was insane. So I'd imagine that's going to go well above.
So if it's not, it's in the top three or four.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Okay, now I know we're not allowed to talk about sprints at all, but what I wanted to ask was, are we allowed to talk about if this game featured how much of a proportion of high intensity in sprints compared to normal? Was this a particularly standout game in that respect, Si?
No, the profile fits. So, of a total distance, there is a set amount that is typical of that would be high speed.
Sprint distance,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, high speed and sprint. And it was fairly standard for us, which is the highest in the league anyway.
Okay.
So we have, at play, we have two of the three highest distance and highest sprinting teams in the league. And they were balls out. It was like that stuff we used to hear about when I was a kid, you know, what derbies are like, or Rangers against Celtic. And everyone's sprinting all over the pitch. And I just thought everybody was sprinting flat out. It was, you know. It wasn't swashbuckling because no one was trying to attack, but it was balls out. There was effort everywhere. It was tremendous.
So if the proportion of sprinting to total distance was in line with what we're doing already, because we did more distance,
So we can quickly just surmise and lead on straight to the next question, and we dropped nearly 15% in intensity. We did drop in distance as well, but we dropped in 15% in intensity of our distance against Sunderland. So more of a greater percentage of our total distance against Sunderland was wandering as opposed to sprinting.
So we have about 15% drop off between Man City in Sunderland. In high speed distance.
Okay. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. anything else before I do lead on to Papa?
Do it.
So we're going to put all these out on with the official account. We're also going to put out the Stoke game. And the Stoke, because I was too lazy to get that done. Unlike Gags, I was far too lazy to get that done over Christmas. and the Stoke game was actually quite interesting. There were some quite interesting, intense periods in that game, particularly before the third goal after half time. But in terms of the City game, this is a real odd one, because it was a super, super hot start. But then we had to see on the chart, it was a gradual cool off throughout the game. So 195 actions, which is the most that we've had this season. But the thing here is that we only had 43% of the possession. So in comparison, last year, the City home game, we had 50-50 possession, but we had 241 actions. So, well, you know, this year we did that a lot less than last year. But the efficiency was quite high as well overall, 88%. But we really front-loaded the pressing in this game. So there was 125 in the first half, 70 in the second. And of the 125, 62 were in the first 15 minutes. So it's not a surprise to see a drop off if the number of actions and the amount of work that was being done early. There was definitely lots of in the second half. It looked to be visibly more hanging on, lots of holding the ball up in the corner flags later on, wasn't there, and all that kind of stuff. But that first 15 minutes, well, actually before that, just on the headline figures for the pressing, top presser was Firmino, perhaps no surprise there, that, with 35. That was his third highest this season. There's all kinds of records broken on presses for this match. Mane was second. That was his most presses this season with 30. Emre had 34 actions. That was his highest this season. But in the corresponding game last season, he got 46 against Man City. That's his highest under Klopp. Wijnaldum had 27. That's his joint best, along with Bournemouth. And his efficiency was 96. So, you know, it's awesome performance from him. Lallana had 28 as a wide forward. So that's a little bit down for him. It's not down. It's his seventh highest under Klopp. And 36 possession wins. 36 possession wins. That's the most this season. Emre with 8, Lallana with 6, Mane with 5, Firmino and Hendo with 4. That is a real standout, 36 possession wins via pressing. But just on that first 15 minutes, so we had 62 actions in that first 15 minutes, 89% efficiency, 32% of our presses in that first 15. Firmino, 14 presses. He pushed City players back 13 times in the first 15 minutes. Emre had 11 presses with 100% efficiency in that first 15. Mane also had 11, Wijnaldum 9, Hendo 7. And in the 8 possession wins in that first 15 as well, Hendo with 3 and Emre with 3. So it was, I think the best way to say it, Si, is we set the tone early on. We scored the goal, got right in amongst City. And then it was almost like, I don't know, what's your view on the off ball fight developed in that game?
I would love to see Wijnaldum's against Yaya and how much he was pressing Yaya, because I thought we slotted nicely between Yaya and Fernandinho and tried to filter them back onto the fullbacks. That Bobby was who was pressing the fullback at 35, it's phenomenal, and I think we had really nice efficiency because we were like I said, we were pressing like in one block of the pitch. And they kept building up, and then we were just pressing that one block. So we actually didn't have to cover a lot of ground, just very short, small sprints. And we had 6 players doing it with two. So we got the front 4 basically, and then we had Hendo and Chan just in behind picking them off.
There was one just before half time where Lallana ambushed. I think it was Lallana ambushed Yaya, didn't he? And it was nearly. We were so close to being clean through, weren't we? I think, yeah. Was it a misplaced pass? We pressed him, and then we just overhit the pass, I think, or the through ball, or yeah. Offside. Rosie, you remember?
I think it was just overhit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, but you know, like you said, we were almost lurking, waiting for Yaya to get it, and then bang, straight in on him, wasn't it?
Yeah. Just what can
and
I
Zabaleta, and Zabaleta, I thought.
Zabaleta got, didn't he get taken off? Yeah, he was being fried. One thing extra to evidence with Papa and the whole pressing is I did a quick table of all basically the percentage of touches a team has that they lose, and the effect of our pressing on their touches. And so City typically lose 20% of their possession, and they lost 25% against us. So we managed to influence it by 5%, which I think is kind of huge.
It's almost the level we disrupt almost, yeah? The opposition.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And a good opposition as well.
Yes, yeah.
Well, 5% of 600-700 touches is a lot, isn't it, as an increase.
Well, Roti, did you hear all the people saying that, oh, City's passing was terrible? And I was like, oh, God, I mean, I thought they were forced into the mistakes because what we were doing.
Exactly. It was clear that that's what was happening. Because when they did have any time, when we did drop off, then they were just knocking it about like there was nobody's business. But once they tried to come into the areas where we were compact or going out wide, you know, that's when the things happened in the game, like you mentioned with Sterling. He was the one who contributed the most in terms of attacking off both teams, but not much because of what we've just been talking about. I think it was the best pressing performance possibly under Klopp, but definitely this season. It was what kept us in the game, stopped them from having any touches, hardly any in the box.
You know, the other great performance that we've had in terms of disruption of norms is the EV. We 9% we increased their possession loss rate. That's the most we've done this season. 9-7 for Spurs as well, by the way.
Wow, that's
7 against Spurs. So against the big teams, it's back to that thing again, isn't it?
Yeah.
Against the big teams, we do the big effort.
Yeah, but I think it's kudos to Klopp for the team selection and the lineup, because I mean there's no doubt that the midfield three were the star for me, the Henderson until he went off, Emre and Wijnaldum, absolutely superb combination. I don't know, it's hard.
Wijnaldum's best game, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, and he had the goal. So you probably got to give him the man of match because of the goal as well. But Emre was just outstanding in that game as well. And I thought Henderson was pretty good before he. Right, the injury. Do we know anything about it, Si?
We don't. They're keeping it under tabs. They reckon it's going to be 10 days. He's going to be missing for 10 days. I think that's interesting.
Is it the same
conclusion?
Same issue?
It's not the same. It might be. The thing is that if anybody listened to the pod that Gags and I did on Hendo's injury, quite in depth,
like plantar
fasciitis, it's caused by the gait. So everyone understands what repetitive strain injury is. Most of the people listening to podcasts will have had it in their wrist or arm at some point. And this is a repetitive strain of basically the bit of flesh that connects the elbow to connects the ankle to the bottom of their toes, and it's just the repetitive strain of pushing down their toes and straightening their ankle. And if you have a running gait that's susceptible to causing it, you have a running gait that's susceptible to causing it. And thankfully, his bad chronic episode snapped, so it's fine on the other foot, but. Unless this is a kick, it's the exact same spot on the other foot, it would worry me, let's say. We don't know. It might well be a kick.
If it is, it's a season ender, isn't it?
If it is, it's a season manager.
Okay, until it snaps.
Well, it might not be that bad.
Okay.
So this might be a minor, but this is something that's...
But it is chronic, though, yeah? It is chronic.
Yeah, it's going to be a thing forever, because his running gait is the same.
Yeah.
It's hard to train a 26-year-old to run differently.
Yeah. Okay.
So it could be much more of a worry. I'm more concerned about it than the headline.
We can't change biomechanics now, can we? Even no, is that the limits of our science?
No, you can change biomechanics, but when you're a footballer and you have to train to be a footballer, right. It's really, really hard to completely change that. You'd have to break it down in the off season and try to retrain. I think it's very unlikely, but next summer might be the best opportunity for it.
Blimey.
Okay. Because we have an empty summer.
Yeah, well, he's got no international in that respect, yeah?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Right, Rosie, anything else on City?
I haven't got anything else, no. I think we need to get on to this Sunderland game.
We have to talk about it.
Right. We do have to. I think we do have to talk about it. Okay, but before we talk about the game itself, I think we need to talk about the team selection. Because on the one of the things we do on this show, and what I like to do on my previous show on the analytics pod, is try and provide information and, you know, almost like a level of education about what happens at, you know, the clubs and inside your club, and to try and give the average fan some insight. And I think we need to try and look at this from the sports science angle, Si. So what I wanted to do was ask you about the Christmas schedule in this country is insane, okay, and it presents a unique challenge. Now, I've tried to break it down. I'm going to break it down into three things, which are the challenges I think it presents. First of all, we're going to talk injury risk. Then we're going to talk about physical fatigue. And then we're going to talk about mental fatigue. Okay? So, I want to start.
Same thing.
Okay. I want to talk about injury risk then. So, can you summarize why the Christmas schedule and the amount of rest, what presents such a problem with the injury risk?
Right. So, there has been no studies on any two games being played in a 48-hour period, because it's that insane. There have just been not the volume of such games to do any form of research, document any form of facts. There's no sample. Yeah. But it's insane. Everybody knows that. So basically, that would be the recovery day from a game of football. Yeah. So instead of having the lightest day of training in a week, and maybe going in a pool and allowing the muscles to regenerate, what you're doing is asking them to be at their absolute peak again before they've repaired. It's insane.
Your body acts like a program. You've been programmed into that being a rest day.
Yes, But also, there's very much that in the English game. So you've got game day plus one, game day plus two, and then it starts to go into game day minus three, game day minus two, game day minus one, and then game again if it's over a week. And there are set protocols in place for that. Or if you've got a Saturday, Wednesday game, how it will go, you would have the day after a game. You might have so it used to be old school. You would have the day off after a game. That was, you know, when we were kids, that's how it would be. Ian Rush would have had the day off after a game, but now it's not what we do. We have the day off after the day after. So it's 2 days after a game, whether you have it off or it's just a regeneration game, a regeneration day where you get a massage, you're filling your body up with the nutrients it needs, because that's the day, that's really the crucial day in recovery. And we're asking it to perform at its highest level and to load itself with the stress that caused it to need repairing in the first place. It's unbelievable, and we're going to go through it all over again, but in a much more intense period this coming Christmas, because I've seen the dates and they're insane. It's like
even more insane in the games. Okay.
Yeah, more insane. I think there are six games in 11 days.
So you mentioned there that scientific studies can't take place on 2 days because we don't have any data for it. So yeah. I take it then that 3 days is
so we know how bodies react.
Yeah.
So there is lots of studies of two games a week as opposed to one game a week. And a two game a week, there is a big 11,000 game study of 2 days a week, of two games a week, basically, over, I think, a 6-year period, cross Europeans, big leagues. And they looked at a 6-week block where there were two games a week. So accumulated fatigue. We've pretty much had this. And then we decided to go for two games in 2 days. And the biggest factor here is increased injury risk, which is huge. So what would be typical game per game is for every 1,000 hours of football played, there will be 13 injuries. Well, what happens when there is two games per week is for every 1,000 hours of football played, there are 53 injuries.
That's massive. And a half times more, yeah.
Yeah, that's massive. That's not you know, just about significant. That's a huge.
Yeah.
There is generally no great difference between total distance covered per match against other per match. Often that we're talking, there's usually around a 6% drop off in high intensity distance, which accumulates and gets compounds throughout that 6-week period. But the problem is that nearly all of the data used in of those games over a 6 week period when there's been two games a week, only I think something like in only eight of those games were more than four players playing in all of those games.
Okay.
Klopp played all of those players, played the same players in all of those games, pretty much. Yeah. So it really is uncharted territory.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so that's injury risk then. So if you think physical and mental fatigue are the same thing as in just fatigue, okay. So so let's assume.
That's not what I'm saying, Dan. So I can carry on this without you even after asking the question. Sorry.
I was asking the question for the listeners.
The injury comes from a mental fatigue, right? So before the physical fatigue happens, there is mental. You get the mental fatigue. Which it kind of works on in varying levels, but so your thinking deteriorates, the speed of your thought goes, but that goes after your neurological, your decision making, but that goes after a neurological fatigue. So how quickly you're firing your muscles basically in coordination together, and that's where injury occurs.
Okay.
Injury comes from a limiting in your coordination, a reduction in your quality of your coordination and your speed of coordination. Yeah. So that's where you're going to get generally a hamstring or a groin injury, because you're accelerating or you're slowing down at with muscles in the wrong order. So you're getting feedback from the muscles at a different rate than you're used to. So you're firing them in an incorrect order. And that's generally where so you're landing and you're basically tensing the wrong muscles at the wrong times, if that makes sense. Yep. So if for that to happen, you will also then be passing the ball to the wrong place because you're also ill coordinated. So your first touch is going to be a little bit off.
To like control. Yeah.
Bobby Firmino, if we see that.
Yeah. Okay. So just for the sake of for the listeners here as well, I mean, how strong or robust is the science in this area of mental fatigue? Because you might think it's quite, extremely complex and difficult to quantify and things like that. Is it still in its infancy, or is it quite well established?
No, it's very much in its infancy.
Okay. We are learning all the time. Yeah.
We're learning all the time. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
So yeah, it's impossible for us to say from a decision making point of view.
Right.
Because it's so subjective.
So there's still very much into trying to prove theories and prove hypotheses against things that happen.
Absolutely, but what we can say is that over the course of these 11,000 games, that skill metrics didn't go down greatly. So like pass percentage and shooting accuracy, they didn't go down from a statistical standpoint.
Okay, was there any correlation between of anything which did go down, or is it yet to be seen?
It's yet to be seen. It's generally it's much more about the injury risk than that's the most important thing, the biggest factor at play here. And we hopefully dodged a bullet. But let me emphasize that the injury risk comes from a lack of coordination. The lack of coordination it does align with the number of touches. So. Prozone, the world does not have access to this. We talk about it a lot. The number of touches per touch.
Okay.
And the number of touches per touch goes up with fatigue.
So no less first time passing, you know, because there's less awareness, less spatial awareness, things like this. Yeah.
We can guess at why. But it does go up. The number of touches per touch goes up. So I'd imagine the first touch quality goes down, and that's where it comes from.
I don't think it's an imagined tie. I think we've seen evidence of it in England teams in World Cups for as long as I've been alive. People they lose the touch. People who have been playing amazing with a great first touch in the Premier League suddenly get towards the end of the season and an international tournament, and the first touch goes. Harry Kane was a completely different human being.
Dele Alli.
Absolutely. What I mean? We've seen it so many times. We've seen it so many times.
There's definite evidence that we see with his eyes. It's hard to quantify exactly, but it's there.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but it is possible to still have energy while being mal-coordinated. So Bobby Firmino can still go and reach whatever his typical performance numbers are. So he's still running 11.8, yet it's not quite as sharp. So you hear of sharpness. In my mind, that's what the sharpness means. It's just that finite ability to gross motor control really quickly and under control.
A couple more questions before we go on to the game.
2 hours and 10 minutes.
Yeah. Is the mental fatigue, is that what other people might call burnout?
I think that's probably an area I don't even know about. That's the stress thing. That's what we see as traditional stressors. That would be a psychologist, you know, angle rather than science angle.
Park that one then. Right. So, and I think the other one, just to wrap up, because we did mention at the start, physical fatigue, and I'm going to parrot it back at you. You're saying, assuming that the injury risk doesn't come to pass, the impact on the physical side is the capacity of the player to cover the high intensity, the same high intensity distance or sprint distance as he normally does, whereas the total distance might still be reachable. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. But there are always going to be outliers, and we had two big outliers in Bobby and I'm now going to call him the cyborg. The Nivea cyborg. You couldn't tell if you just wrote the numbers down. You would have no idea, but pretty much across the board, everybody else was down, and a couple of players. I don't even need to mention the names. Everybody will know who I'm talking about if you saw the game. A couple of them had absolute stinkers. It was almost like they couldn't move. You couldn't profile them from looking at their numbers to who they are.
Everybody, you look at it on the shot, saying that's an outlier. That's an outlier.
Exactly. Exactly. And I wouldn't be expecting to see them this weekend.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we can talk about dodging bullets from this week, right? But yeah, we've talked about plenty of times on this from the fatigue index that we now have across the board. We have 12 players that have got spikes, load spikes that are built in because of the FA. Nothing to do with Klopp really, apart from he only used 14 players when he could have used 25. But they now have load spikes, so they are greatly susceptible. They are. You, right up there in Arsene Wenger's red zone going forward.
Yeah.
Over the next 3 weeks.
Okay.
So a spike often causes injury 2 weeks later.
So the next Premier League game is Man United, is that right?
Man United,
away.
But a lot of these players are going to play before that, aren't they?
You think they're going to play against Southampton?
I'd expect them all to be playing against Southampton.
Mm. Okay.
I'd expect most of them to be playing on Saturday, in fairness.
Well, okay. Right. So final question. It's not a question. It's an area that we wanted to
Sunday.
I know you looked at from the official account of AI Under Pressure, is the context of our team selections over the Christmas period in comparison to everybody else's team selections over the Christmas period. So do you want to just cover that off quickly?
I haven't added in down to Arsenal and Bournemouth who got to play last night, but yeah, Arsenal was a fried as well because Arsenal didn't have an extra day because they played Sunday. But Bournemouth did have the extra day. So basically I looked at the number of starters used in each game and then the amount of time that was played by substitutes. So that relieved our starters of load, basically, and then also the number of hours between the three games. So Liverpool, start off with the most absurd, and I heard on the radio the manager being slaughtered. Southampton had to play three games in 117 hours.
Yeah,
that is absolutely absurd. And Chelsea got 284 hours, I think, to play their four games.
I don't know. It's not a level playing field, that Southampton and Chelsea. That can't be allowed to happen, can it?
No,
can't be.
No. No. It really shouldn't be. They've got a huge favour. Anyway, so Southampton had to make substitutes. Southampton used the most substitutes. Their subs used 254 minutes over the three games, which you would expect, but they lost all their games. So what can you do? They're always constantly playing catch up. Liverpool. So the starters went. Middlesbrough had 18 starters over the course of their three games. Leicester, Sunderland, also, they used 18. Southampton, Man United, 17. Everton used 16. City used 15, but they had 204 minutes of subs. Burnley, 14. But what choice did they have? West Ham, 14. West Brom, who don't run, they had 13. Liverpool had 13, along with Hull. Starters used over the course of these games. And we can discuss how many we would have used if nobody got injured. And we also, along with having the lowest number of starters used, we also used the second 151 minutes of subs. We used the second lowest number of subs, which is, it just seems to me to be sticking your finger in the plug socket and seeing if you get stung. We have players. I honestly can't comprehend from a science point of view why we would spread our resources not spread them thinly. Yeah, why we were so focused, so concentrated on having the exact same players. It started to worry me in November, our lack of rotation. Bear in mind, at some point, fatigue generally catches up with players towards the end of the season. It's my opinion anyway, that in 13, 14, that's exactly what happened to three of our players. They just got tired and no longer were they the same presence in the last six games. Suarez and Sturridge just weren't the same presence as they were earlier in the season. And what our players are currently are going at a level, an absurd level, that is more than Suarez had to go through. They also seem to be fitter than I've ever seen before as well. So maybe they're creating their own science.
Mm.
Let's see how they recover. But whether it's good, whether it's bad, we did have the lowest number of starters and pretty much the lowest number of subs.
So I'm going to bring Rhodey back in, Rhodey, because thank you for being patient. do we want to try?
I thought that was by far the best bit of the episode so far. So learn from it.
Do we want to attempt to read the manager's mind and guess why there was only one change between City and Sunderland?
Yeah, because I think, as Si just mentioned there, he was worried in November about certain amounts of rotation. There's no hindsight going on here. We didn't look at the result and then suddenly say, oh, duh, anger. You know, before the game, I think you were tweeting about it, Dan. You said seven changes. I thought six. I thought Mane had stayed in. But we're talking similar changes, you know, Moreno coming in for Milner from the start, maybe Stewart for Henderson, because Henderson was obviously injured, Origi and Sturridge for Firmino or Lallana, maybe Gomez. I thought Clavin should have definitely been rested because some of the other players have played over Christmas and festive periods before. There might be somewhere in there. Clavin would have never done that, would it? Ever. He'd have had a break every single winter of his whole career, and then you're asking him to play two games in such a short. So I would have rested him. I thought mentally he wasn't there. Maybe Trent Alexander-Arnold for Klein, but I think Klein is in the Lallana Cyborg kind of range and durability levels. Ejaria for Wijnaldum, who I thought was the worst player. So those were that we were talking about before the game as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's going to be plenty of shows on this channel about what does this mean for the squad and what does this mean for the January window. I think others can have lots of fun with that. But I now want to, because I'm conscious of time, let's move on to Sunderland on the ball, Rhodey. So we had all this hoo-ha, right, over the team selection and what we did. So how good was the on-ball performance?
Excellent. Away from home, 21 shots. You know, we've talked about volume of shots before. How much does that mean? 12 shots in the box, again, away from home. That's in your top 10%. It rarely happens. Three big chances as well. Rarely happens.
Three big chances. That was Mane goal.
Yeah.
And Sturridge.
Sturridge, the back heel from Lallana.
Not the header, no.
Absolutely dominated touches in the box, 40-12. Expected goals, again, impressive, and in terms of shot quality. So
what was the expected goals numbers?
It was 2.1 to 0.5. Now, that's not including the penalties. We haven't included any of our penalties all season when we've been discussing expected goals.
Just a note to everybody listens that we use a shot-based expected goals model that excludes own goals and penalties. And that actually we should also mention, I think this is a worthwhile addition, that the Defoe, when he was through, and Mignolet made a fantastic claim, because Defoe didn't shoot, that doesn't get counted in the expected goals models.
Exactly, and it's kind of important in the game context as well, even when you're talking about game states. So in the overall numbers, yeah. So if he scores, was it 0-0? I think so. So in terms of on the ball stats, really,
it was 1-0 by that point.
Was it?
No, it was 1-1 by that point.
I thought it was. I thought it had been a goal. It was just after their penalty, wasn't it?
Yeah, just after their penalty, yeah.
Interesting, this is a side note, because there is such a thing as non-shots expected goals models, which take into account the areas of the pitch teams get into, whether they shoot or not. So I think as those kind of models become more prevalent and available to us, where you can pinch and borrow on this part, I think we'll start doing that. But I think it's fair to say, Dan, that they're not that. There's not that much traction with those at the moment, are there?
No, I rarely see many up to date game by game ones. It's occasionally ones used in individual articles, but there's not much.
I see them in the industry, and they are not to the point where teams are playing by them yet, but there are so many other factors involved. By the time you're shooting, it's reduced it to a much more of a closed skill opportunity than from areas of the pitch.
Yeah.
Because there are so many other factors of where players are on the pitch by that point.
Yeah.
It's hard to then create an accurate model, and nobody's there quite yet.
There was a big one in each game, to be honest, because the Milner pass for Firmino in the City game would have shown up quite well in a non-shots expected goals model as well.
Yeah.
As well as the Defoe one. Okay. So
just one, Dan, do what do we think about? I think it's the offside rule. I hate that was offside.
I hate the offside rule. God, I was doing my nut with the linesman against City. Yeah.
If whoever that guy is from midfield that was offside, if he's not offside, if he's not interfering with play, why are our players stepping up?
Yeah.
They played him offside.
Yeah.
And Defoe touched him as he went past.
There was one in the City game. In fact, there was two, I think, in the City game. Sort of Sterling and Emery, I think it was. There was everybody knew it, and the whole ground knew it was offside. The ref, the linesman, didn't put his flag up, and both players had to make a 30-yard sprint to get to the ball. And then when they got to the ball, then he put his flag up because what's the point of that? Why is that point? Anyway, I digress.
Sturridge was outstanding. Six shots. We had 15 shots on target away from home.
Now six we need shots to look all on shot target for Sturridge.
Six shots on target. When have you seen that before?
No, you don't.
I have to agree with Gags in the comments there. That's the most scouts I've ever heard. Dan, that was great.
Oh, sorry.
That was it. Yeah, so Sturridge was unbelievable. Brilliant. I thought he was the best player on the pitch by some distance, but that's just me.
He could be, because why could he have been the best player on the pitch? Is it because he's a good player, or is it because he was well rested?
You know what? That undermines my theory behind Klopp not rotating at this point, is that the players that were playing are primed and ready to go, and because he hasn't previously rotated, the understudies aren't, match up.
Yeah.
That's why he went with the first team. And then Sturridge comes in and is easily the best player on the pitch, and he behaves like he's the best player on the pitch. Knows he's the best player on the pitch, and everybody else treats him like he's the best player on the pitch.
Do you remember in 2014-15 when he was out for like literally about 6 months, and he came back against West Ham and he scored a brilliant goal from a tight angle within about 2 minutes of coming on after about six months later. He's one of these players. I don't think he needs to get back up to speed. He just goes in, hits the ground running. He just takes ages to come back. When he has a minor knock, seems to take longer with him. I think that's my concern.
Maybe the thing is that other people come back before they're ready, and
good
he
point.
Doesn't. He comes back when he's ready, and they come back, and you have to watch them get to form, and you don't watch Sturridge get to form. He just is, or he's not playing.
That's a fascinating way of looking at it, actually. Yes, more of that, please. So just on the on-ball stuff, Dan, do you think that we had an issue with shot quality against Sunderland? We had all these fantastic shot numbers. Do you think there was an issue with shot quality?
No, I thought... if you're looking at it just in terms of volume of shots, I don't think we had anywhere near 21 decent quality shots. I thought at least half of them were wasted, but three big chances, like you say, 15 shots on target, 12 shots inside the box. That's plenty enough to win a game away from home if you're looking at a shot profile. It was bang on our season average, in case you were wondering, shot quality. So it was not really. Maybe we should exploit some of Sunderland's woes at the back a bit more. But I thought, just in terms of the numbers, it's a quite an impressive away performance.
Yeah. My overriding concern watching the game was that I thought we got into lots of good spaces and areas of the pitch, but we ended up maybe shooting too much or shooting too early instead of maybe passing it again. Did you get that feeling, Dan, or was that just me?
Sturridge's one where he's in that little half space on the edge of the box and he seemed to have a little bit more of a burst to get past the player. And then he shoots with his left foot, curling it. That's for me is, you know, I like that kind of decision making because he gets a little bit of space. Sometimes there's a crowded area and he's got the ability to curl it outside the post and back in. So people with that kind of quality, I don't mind in those little areas on the edge of the box. We've seen him score many. My point, particularly in this game, is that maybe they were a bit more. Some of the shots on target, if you look at them, they are kind of all on the edge of the box as well. But still, I think I've focused on attacking metrics here. It's the coming back to your fatigue issues that you were talking about. The mental fatigue in the box, the handball. Is that instinctive or is that because he's tired? The sandwiching of a player when in previous games, Clavin wouldn't have got himself in that position. That's what cost us a game.
Yeah. I just thought that, I was wondering if you, because I know you're a big one on shot decision making for shots and when to shoot and when not to shoot and when to play. And I thought that was a bit of a red flag for me on the weekend, but maybe it was just me then. Maybe I was expecting too much. I thought we got into enough good positions that we should have seen something more like Watford at home. You know, we had ridiculous shots in the box and ridiculous percentage of shots in the box, shots on target and all that kind of stuff. And
I thought Watford were more open against Sunderland than we did against Stoke, but we scored four against Stoke.
Yeah, we had no big chances against Stoke either, did we?
Exactly. So.
No, I was saying
nothing to do with... We didn't lose that game because we didn't create enough.
That's my point.
Yeah.
We lost the game because we were fucking stupid.
Yeah. Considering we had 13 shots on target, I thought we didn't make... You know, that Manone didn't have many that many good saves.
No, he had two good saves, both from Sturridge, I think. Like one that, for 1 point up, to put it as a shot off target, but I think it was going to curl in. First half, and then the other one from that we scored from the corner, the back heel from Lallana, and then and I think that was a good save as well. And then we scored from the corner anyway.
Yeah,
I thought we didn't control them. I thought we didn't control. We allowed them to get to our box too easily for both times for the penalties, only twice, and they weren't egregious enough errors like we've had previously where Lovren or Lucas has done something that's really stupid and just given a goal away. Or a Mané handball. But then that came from a stupid Lucas free kick that was completely unnecessary. As always. And the goals, they come about from mistakes, don't they? And there's a crescendo of errors to get to the both of those.
It was
a stupid throw in, and Wijnaldum got the wrong side, and he pushed him into Clavin when there was a guy that was stood right behind Clavin he was going to run into if he'd have just opened his mouth and obviously didn't shout.
Yeah. See, I'm to be honest, I don't know about you, Si, but I'm pretty loath to criticise anybody for the Sunderland game because for all the reasons that we talked about in the preamble. Okay. Bit. Because, yeah, because it's a unique situation. It's not a normal scenario, is it, for them? So, yeah, I mean, yeah.
I think the only criticism you can have is entirely with the manager. And I think the manager, by making that team selection, he said he, that's literally what he's done. He's gone, if this doesn't work, this is on me. And I'm big enough to cope with it. And it's okay. And you're allowed to, to criticize a manager sometimes. It's fine. Yeah. It doesn't mean we don't respect his brilliance.
No.
It was a gamble and it didn't work.
I'm glad you highlighted that, Dan, because all the players just get a complete clean slate for this game. There's no...
Yeah,
I'm not going to look back to mistakes in this game and think I'm going to castigate Mane for handball or Clavin for being slightly off.
No. Can I just say this, on ball, this is the first time this season that our little Nivea cyborg has had the most touches. Typically, he's like around 58. Let me look at his season averages, touches per game. Yeah, we're talking like he typically has 70 touches per game.
Yeah.
And per 90. But he's actually only like 58 touches per game, but it's 70 touches per 90. And he had the most at 106.
Wow.
106 touches. And I like... That's, we can say what we like. Generally, I think Sturridge is our best player by miles, and then Coutinho and Firmino's been brilliant as well. But like currently on form, Lallana's right up there. You want either Lallana or Wijnaldum to have. Wijnaldum never gets many touches. We kind of bypass him. So I think he's peaked at 68 touches this season. I don't think he's ever had more than that. But Lallana dominating, demanding the ball and running the game. That's basically what number of touches. And so Lovren, who in our poorer games is getting well above 90 because we're recycling when Henderson and Lovren and Clavin at the back, just recycling between them. And Milner, Lallana picked up the slack of Milner not being around, of Hendo not being around, and ran with it alongside Chan, who had 105 touches and pretty much 90 passes and 16 ball recoveries, despite being shocking.
Yeah.
It isn't the same. It's not the same human being from last season, this Adam Lallana, is it?
He's only half human now. He's half machine, half human. Yeah.
I'd love to see the psychological profile of him, because he is now dominant. Yeah. This is his team. He looks like he can. He is ready to. I'd honestly rather of him taking the captain's armband than Lovren.
Yeah.
This is my team. He looked like he, you know, was putting the team on his back, and we're going to win this because I'm going to do something that's going to win this game for us. And he always, to me, he looked like he wanted to get away from that being that one decisive guy. He wanted to be the guy before it, but not the actual decisive guy now. He just wants it.
Maybe he is, Adam. In the off season, maybe he had adamantium melded onto his skeleton. But nobody knows. Yeah. Anyway, let's talk about
people. Are people. They're not just, you know. It's not. They're not just footballers. Like, people change in life, don't they? I'm not the same guy I was when I was 24. And you know, you can gain some real, actual self confidence, rather than the bravado stuff you get before that.
Yeah.
And I think maybe it's just like that. Maybe he believes he's this good, and he didn't before.
Or he sees credibility in the words coming out of one manager's mouth and not the others.
It matters. Yeah, it really matters. And now he believes it, because he's a different player. He's not the same guy at all.
Anyway, enough with the Lallana loving. That was last episode. Right. Off ball. Right, total distance. Very quick. Let's do the off ball quite quickly. Total distance were right. Let's tell the story. 120.2 against Stoke. That was the highest of the season for us.
Yeah.
118 against City.
Yep.
About fourth highest.
It's right up there. Yeah.
Yeah, and then
we're down to what I don't actually know. Sorry, I store what people don't realize is that I store the data, the distance data, without goalkeeper on our sheet. Okay. We're down at 108,
yeah,
but we've 108. Got a goalie. We've got goalie on top of that. So, Karius was 4.7 and Mignolet's 3.2 average. So we're looking at a 112. I should have looked it up again, because I did when I put it in, but I only remembered the actual sheet number. So we're looking at about 112. And that's, that's around the lowest number we have.
Yeah. Okay. And we've already covered the sprint distance, about 15% down from from average as well. So that we talked about that at length. So in terms of the individuals, then, if Lallana,
Mr. Cyborg,
as we saw on Sky, we tweeted up from the account, did 13 point something in this match as well.
13.221.
It's just astonishing. Right, and we've already mentioned that Chan had quite a high number, 11.5, was it, you said?
11.5, yeah, 11.5. Yeah. Bobby's a little bit lower than 11.5.
Where was the drop-off then?
Drop-off is across the back line. That was a fairly significant drop. We weren't pushing up anywhere near as high and making as much movements for a start. So we're getting a couple of kilometres here, and I honestly don't want to pinpoint two of our most egregious characters, because it sounds like blame and it's not their fault. Okay. So we had a couple of players who dropped off massively.
So we'll just say that some of the players had hit a brick wall, basically.
Yes. And we'll leave it at that. Exactly that. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So they were literally at the limits of their capacity. Yeah. Okay. We're not gonna name names. Okay. Let's leave it at that. I think that's fair. Right. Okay. So Papa, should we move on to Papa?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay. So Papa's overall again tells a good story. So we had the most important thing to remember, though, the difference to the City game is that Papa is possession adjusted, and so we had 71% of the ball and 129 pressing actions. And that's in fact, is virtually identical to the Sunderland home game last season, where we had 73% possession and 123 actions. And Hull at home earlier this season was similar, 74% possession and 132. Overall, the efficiency was good, again, 88%. The story here, though, just 17 possession wins. That's the second lowest of the season after the Burnley game. And we didn't have any presses leading to a shot in this game either. In terms of the top players... top presser in this game, actually, this might be the first time we've seen this. It was Mane. So this was a really good performance by his normal standards, because he's averaging about every 6 minutes, and in this game it was every 4 minutes. So you know, in a game where we had 71% of the ball, you know, and he saw a lot of it, he was putting a shift in down that right flank. Lallana,
yeah, he averages 15 a game.
Yeah. So there's a lot more for him in this game, yeah. Lallana with 24, is just bang, absolutely bang on his average when he plays in centre mid. Firmino was 20. That was way off the pace by his standards, every 5 minutes instead of every 3.7. Emre was slightly down, every 5.1 minutes compared to his season average of 4.1. But he did have, he was top possession wins with 6 and 95% efficiency, which is excellent. And Wijnaldum was pro rata, you know, he was actually, before he went off, he was actually better than his season average as well. So, and 10 from fullback from Klein was also quite high for fullback. So if you look at the Papa chart, there's a couple of periods of, you know, of high intensity in there, particularly in the second half, where in terms of the pressing, the most intense period of the match was between 60 and 80 minutes. And with 37 pressings actions, Lallana with 8, Mane with 7, and this is like, you know, after two games in two days, in 48, less than 48 hours, and then, you know, we have a surge towards, you know, trying to get that second and third goal. I think it does say something about the underlying fitness, to me anyway, Sati, it says something about the underlying fitness levels.
Like 100%.
Maybe they are the fittest they've ever been. Maybe they are creating their own science as they're going along.
They are 100% as fit as they've ever been, but they are also playing a team that also played two days before.
Yeah.
So, and they're not as fit as we are. I know this for a fact. They're not as fit as we are. And they're definitely not as fit as they could be. So their drop-off's going to be greater than ours.
Yeah. And their one average distance is one of the lowest in the league, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, it's one of the lower ones in the league, for sure. Yeah.
Well, not quite West Brom.
No. But alongside the pressing, one thing that stands out is the thing that I talked about with the last one, with the possession loss, rate of possession loss. When we played them at home, Sunderland have an average, they lose possession 29% of total touches. And at home, we managed to increase that to 36%. But on there on Monday, it was down to only 30. So we did affect it a little bit, but it was really 1%, if that. So, yeah, I don't think we disrupted their game an awful lot. Despite still creating chances because they're shite.
So, and one thing we will put out with the official account is, you know, for the City game, we'll put out that the pressing map of the first 15 minutes when there was all those actions. But in this game, there was a real bias towards the right hand side, the pressing actions towards our right, really concentrated. So we'll put that pressing map out for the Sunderland game with the official account, so people can have a look at that. But in terms of off ball, is there anything else you wanted to cover, Si?
Not particularly. How many touches did they have in our box that we restricted them to?
14? 12.
So more than Man City?
They had 12. Same as City. And Stoke. All had the same.
I mentioned earlier, didn't I, in the group that we'd conceded 62 touches in our box in the last six games, and we had 65 in the first game of that sequence against West Ham.
And they had, they had 12 touches in the box, and two of them were penalty kicks. PKs. Bob Bradley. right.
I think we've done the game, John.
Right. This is... this has been a marathon podcast, right? So I think to try and sum up, Dan, and I'll come to you in a minute, Si, we have to try and make an objective assessment of this Sunderland match, because it was unique circumstances, as we've said. So considering all the factors as we have, well, I think we've tried to cover everything, was the performance that we put in, was it good enough? In quotes, good enough. Was it good enough?
Absolutely. Absolutely good enough in terms of, I think I clarified it before, it's really good in terms of chance creation away from home. Obviously, we've got that spike in the pressing. That's incredible. We've got the cyborg figures. I do think Klopp made a mistake. I would have liked to have seen 5-6 changes, but he's paid all this money to make decisions where both decisions could be interpreted as a mistake. So there's no hindsight going on here. The fact that we conceded two penalties, Dan, how often does that happen?
I think it's about 1% of Premier League games. concedes two penalties.
The one this season was Man City at home to Everton had two, missed them both. I can't think of any other games where there's been two this season. Yeah. Did Milner have two?
That was the one where the press said Koeman killed Tiki Taka, and you know when Man City missed two pens. Okay.
Yes, and if you take into account the context of the festive period of four games, you know, 13 out of 15 is usually good enough.
How far back are we taking 15, the festive period?
12. Ten out of 12. So that's usually good enough.
And we can talk about tonight's results, obviously.
In the league, especially when Chelsea have lost the winning streak. Spurs have won 2-0.
So
live reporting here from the underplay.
So Arsenal, we got the same points return as Arsenal. Yeah? 10 out of 12. Obviously City were 9 out of 12, yeah? And so Chelsea now 9 out of 12. United 12. And then Spurs 12 out of 12? Yeah, okay, so Spurs, the only ones who got 100% points return over the press were Spurs and United.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, thanks for our live reporting team there. Ty, do you think the performance was good enough?
I think the performance was absolutely fine. I think, if anything, I was less high on the performance against City than everybody else. And I'm more high on the performance against Sunderland than everybody else.
Given
the circumstances, but we also created good chances. We did more than enough to win this game. We didn't win this game. It's the result that's not acceptable.
Yeah. Okay.
Given the game states, it would just piss me off forever. And there's nothing they could do about it. Apart from Chelsea not winning against Spurs.
Yeah.
That's the only mitigating factor.
Yeah. It's softened the blow a bit in that respect. So the other thing we have to assess, is that we talked about the injury risk and the known science there, which is that part of the the sports science world is widely accepted, isn't it? Those studies there. Yeah. So the manager rolled the dice, didn't he, over the Christmas period with what he did? Okay.
Yeah.
So I don't think that is in dispute at all.
Right? I think if anybody actually asked him the damn question in a press conference, he would openly accept it and admit it.
So we got three injuries that we know about over that Christmas schedule. Okay. Now, one of those, Sturridge, was an impact, so that can be discounted because that's under the shit happens banner, isn't it? Impact injuries, yeah. So we had two attritional injuries: one to Hendo, which is Milner, which we think is muscular, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. There might be more knocks that we don't know about, but they're the ones that we do. Is that overall? Did we get away with it?
Absolutely got away with it. Absolutely got away with it. And if that's the worst case scenario, I'm taking that every time. And not just with this particular Christmas period, in any Christmas period. Two injuries over Christmas and nothing serious. That's phenomenal. It's phenomenal.
Asterisk on Hendo, obviously, there. Yeah.
Asterisk on Hendo, but that's chronic and probably nothing to do with Christmas.
Okay. So you might just say it's just the Milner one then.
Yeah, indeed. For now. Let's discuss this at the end of January and see what the repercussions are, if there are any.
We have 8 more games potentially in January.
Yeah.
seven more, plus 8 if there's a replay in the cup, I think.
Really?
No, there are no replays. Didn't replays get abolished in the FA Cup?
I hope so.
Isn't that one of the concessions the FA made this year?
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it is. If it's not, it starts from next season, but they definitely made that decision, the old fellas at the FA.
On a bright note
for context here, using Chelsea not winning, so we're only 5 points behind Chelsea, is that looking at the more advanced stats, which you boys love to play with, PDO, Chelsea's PDO is 113.
Yeah, that's going to come down.
And ours is 103.
Well, we saw that tonight because Spurs had 2 shots on target and scored both, and Chelsea had 2 and missed, and that's PDO regression right there. So,
Exactly. So, I think there are 3 studies I've seen that suggest that any run over 6 games, any winning run over 6 games, when there is a loss occurs, there is well over 50% chance that the second loss happens within the next 2 games. So I'm down with that.
So overall, let me just try and sum up. We're trying to provide information to everybody. We're not slaughtering anybody. We're not hammering the manager. We try to give an honest appraisal of what we think, in terms of how we see it, and that we're fans at heart, and I really hope this has been a really difficult show to put together. It's been a very time consuming and it's been a very long listen, but at the end of the day, I really hope this has been a worthwhile show, and I really encourage, if you've got any feedback at all, please get in touch with me, Rhodesy, Gags and Cy, and let us know what you think. Because we really hope you enjoyed this one. Thanks, everybody.
We do. Don't get in touch with me, though.
Or me, if you've got anything negative to say.
Okay. Cheers. Bye. Network.